the river. Not since taking command the summer of 1775 had Washington ever addressed the army with such words of praise, affection, and gratitude as he did in his general orders for the following day, December 27th. And never had he greater reason. It had been their triumph, he wanted them to know. The general, with the utmost sincerity and affection, thanks the officers and soldiers for their spirited and gallant behavior at Trenton yesterday, he began. It is with inexpressible pleasure that he can declare that he did not see a single instance of bad behavior in either officers or privates. In appreciation of such spirited behavior, he would see that all who had crossed the river would receive in cash a proportionate part of the total value of the cannon, arms, horses, and everything else captured at Trenton. Allegedly, there had been some less than stellar behavior, which either Washington did not see or chose to ignore given the spirit of the moment. With the battle over, a number of soldiers reportedly broke into the Hessian rum supply and got roaring drunk. Far more, however, would be said later and repeated endlessly of Hessians who supposedly, on the morning of the attack, were still reeling drunk or in a stupor, having celebrated Christmas in the Germanic tradition. But there is no evidence that any of them were drunk. John Greenwood, who was in the thick of the fight, later wrote, "I am willing to go upon oath that I did not see even a solitary drunken soldier belonging to the enemy." Major James Wilkinson, the young officer who had been present at the capture of General Lee, and who also fought at Trenton and later wrote an account of the battle, made no mention of anyone being drunk. What Wilkinson did record, memorably, was riding to Washington with a message just after the Hessians had surrendered. "On my approach," he wrote, "the commander-in-chief took me by the hand and observed, 'Major Wilkinson, this is a glorious day for our country.'" They all felt something of the kind. They knew they had done something big at last. The troops behaved like men contending for everything that was dear and valuable, Knox wrote to Lucy. Nathaniel Green told his wife, "This is an important period to America, big with great events." Writing to Governor Trumbull earlier, Washington had prophesied that some lucky blow would rouse the spirits of the people. But he could hardly have imagined how stunning the effect of the news of Trenton would be on the morale of the country. In a matter of days, newspapers were filled with accounts of Washington's crossing of the Delaware, the night march, and the overwhelming success of the surprise attack, the numbers of prisoners taken, the cannon, arms, swords, horses, even the number of drums and trumpets from Colonel Rawl's military band. But fast post riders and word of mouth spread the story more rapidly still. John Adlam, the 17-year-old private from York, Pennsylvania, who had been captured at Fort Washington and was among the fortunate prisoners, mostly officers, confined to houses in New York and allowed some freedom of movement, wrote later of how he heard the news of Trenton. The owner of a grocery store had pulled him into a back room and kept shaking his hand and trembling with such emotion he was unable to speak. "I looked at him and I thought him crazy or mad," Adlam wrote, "but as soon as he could give utterance to his word, he says to me, 'General Washington has defeated the Hessians at Trenton this morning and has taken 900 prisoners and 6 pieces of artillery.' I did not wait to hear anything more said, but dropped the basket and ran out into the street and past 2 British sentinels that I had given the countersign on my way to the store. Though they challenged me, I did not stop, but ran as fast as I could to my quarters. By the time I got home, I was quite out of breath and ran into the room where the officers were sitting around the table. Several of them asked, 'What's the matter?' And as soon as I could recover breath to speak, I spoke with considerable emphasis, 'General Washington has defeated the Hessians at Trenton this morning and has taken 900 prisoners and 6 pieces of artillery.' 'Who told you so?' 'I could not tell, as I did not know the gentleman's name, but I told them it was where I purchased the groceries,' at which some of the officers laughed and asked me various questions, while others did not say a word and looked very serious, as if doubting the news, and others thought it too good to be true. Washington was extolled as he had been at Boston, as a hero and savior. "It appears to us that your attack on Trenton was a success beyond expectation," wrote Robert Morris from Philadelphia, on behalf of the Executive Committee of Congress. "And this was entirely befitting a character which we admire and which we have long wished to appear in the world with that brilliancy that success always obtains, and which members of Congress know you deserve." From Baltimore, addressing Washington on behalf of the entire Congress, John Hancock said that the victory at Trenton was all the more extraordinary, given that it had been achieved by men broken by fatigue and ill fortune. "But troops properly inspired and animated by a just confidence in their leader will often exceed expectation or the limits of probability. As it is entirely to your wisdom and conduct, the United States are indebted for the late success of your arms." To General James Grant, Howe's commander of the New Jersey outposts, and thus the one who bore the responsibility for what had happened, Trenton was an unlucky, cursed affair, quite beyond comprehension. "'Tis an infamous business. I cannot account for the misbehavior of the Hessians," Grant wrote to General Harvey. "He had been sure," Grant told Harvey, "that the Hessians at Trenton were as safe as you are in London." How Colonel Rawl could have failed to act upon the warning he had been given was more than Grant could understand. But then Rawl had died of his wounds and would have no chance to speak in his own defense. In New York, William Howe responded to the news of Trenton by taking immediate action. Cornwallis, his leave canceled, was ordered to return at once to New Jersey with an army of 8,000. Washington had been weighing his next move and worrying over how possibly to keep his army together. His decision, given the way events had turned and his own nature, was not surprising. He would go after the enemy once again. Thinking that Washington was still in New Jersey, General Cadwallader, in a bold move, had crossed the Delaware downstream at Bristol, and General Mifflin was joining him with more recruits. On December 29th, Washington, Greene, Sullivan, Knox, and their troops were on the move, marching through a 6-inch snowfall to cross the Delaware at McConkie's Ferry and nearby Yardley's Ferry, an undertaking that was as harrowing as the crossing of Christmas night. At Yardley's Ferry, where Greene's troops crossed, the river was iced over, just thick enough for the men to pick their way warily across, but too thin for horses and cannon. At McConkie's, it was only with the greatest difficulty that Washington and the rest were able to get over. Amazingly, Knox and Glover succeeded this time in transporting some 40 cannon and their horses, twice what had been managed Christmas night. At Trenton, Washington drew up his forces on a low ridge along the south side of Assunpink Creek, with the Delaware on their left flank, a patch of woods to the right. It was December 30th. The following day, the last day of 1776, he made a dramatic appeal to the veteran troops of the Continental Army to stay with him. Having no authority whatever to do so, he offered a bounty of $10 for all who would stay another 6 months after their enlistments expired that day. A considerable sum for men whose pay was $6 a month. "I feel the inconvenience of this advance," Washington would later tell Congress, "but what was to be done?" To Robert Morris he said more bluntly, "I thought it no time to stand on trifles." One of the soldiers would remember his regiment being called into formation, and His Excellency, astride a big horse, addressing them in the most affectionate manner. The great majority of the men were New Englanders, who had served longer than any, and who had no illusions about what was being asked of them. Those willing to stay were asked to step forward. Drums rolled, but no one moved. Minutes passed. Then Washington wheeled his horse about and spoke again. "My brave fellows, you have done all I asked you to do, and more than could be reasonably expected. But your country is at stake, your wives, your houses, all that you hold dear. You have worn yourselves out with fatigues and hardships. but we know not how to spare you. If you will consent to stay 1 month longer, you will render that service to the cause of liberty and to your country, which you can probably never do under any other circumstance." Again the drums sounded, and this time the men began stepping forward. "God Almighty," wrote Nathaniel Green, "inclined their hearts to listen to the proposal, and they engaged anew." In the last hours before New Year's Day, Washington would learn that on December 27th, by the vote of Congress, he had been authorized to use every endeavor, including bounties, to prevail upon the troops to stay with the Army. Indeed, for a period of 6 months, the Congress at Baltimore had made him a virtual dictator. "Happy it is for this country," read part of the letter transmitting the resolution, "that the general of their forces can be safely entrusted with the most unlimited power, and neither personal security, liberty, nor property be in the least degree endangered thereby." In his letter of reply to the members of Congress, Washington wrote, "Instead of thinking myself freed from all civil obligations by this mark of their confidence, I shall constantly bear in mind that as the sword was the last resort for the preservation of our liberties, so it ought to be the first thing laid aside when those liberties are firmly established." The year 1776 is over. I am heartily glad of it, and I hope you nor America will ever be plagued with such another, Robert Morris wrote to Washington on New Year's Day. But the campaign was not over just yet. By January 1, 1777, Cornwallis and his army had reached Princeton. On January 2, Cornwallis left part of his force there, and with 5,500 strong, set off down the road to Trenton, 10 miles away. There had been a sudden thaw, and the mud of the road slowed the march. Colonel Edward Hand and the Pennsylvania riflemen sent to check the enemy advance fought with deadly effect, but could only fall back against such a force. By dusk, the Americans were retreating back through Trenton, down Queen Street toward the bridge over the Assunpink, and it was only Knox's cannon from across the creek that held the British at bay. "The enemy pushed our small party through the town with vigor, then advanced within reach of our cannon, who saluted them with great vociferation and some execution," Knox wrote. British artillery answered, and Cornwallis ordered 3 successive attacks on the bridge, only to be driven back each time. Dr. Benjamin Rush, who had arrived with Cadwallader's brigade to help establish a field hospital, wrote later of this his first direct encounter with war. Indeed, Rush was one of the very few signers of the Declaration of Independence yet to see the reality of war firsthand. The American army retired and left the British in possession of Trenton. The scene which accompanied and followed this combat was new to me. The first wounded man that came off the field was a New England soldier. His right hand hung a little above his wrist by nothing but a piece of skin. It had been broken by a cannonball. I took charge of him and directed him to a house on the river, which had been appropriated for a hospital. In the evening, all the wounded, about 20 in number, were brought to this hospital and dressed by Dr. John Cochran, myself, and several young surgeons who acted under our direction. We all lay down on some straw in the same room with our wounded patients. It was now for the first time war appeared to me in its awful plenitude of horrors. I want words to describe the anguish of my soul, excited by the cries and groans and convulsions of the men who lay by my side. In the last light of day, Cornwallis and his commanders had convened to decide whether to carry the attack across the Assunpink still again, or to wait for daylight. "If Washington is the general I take him to be," one of them, Sir William Erskine, is alleged to have commented, "he will not be found in the morning." Cornwallis is said to have replied that they would bag him in the morning. It was an understandable decision. Night attacks could be extremely costly, and there seemed no reason not to wait. The British engineer Captain Archibald Robertson thought the Americans had positioned themselves extremely well. "We durst not attack them," Robertson recorded in his diary. They were in exactly the position Rawls should have taken when he was attacked, from which he might have retreated towards Bordenstown, downstream on the Delaware, with very little loss. It had turned cold again. The British troops slept that night on the frozen ground and without campfires, in order to keep watch on the rebels and their fires across the creek. But when morning came, the Americans were gone. Leaving a small force to keep the fires burning and make the appropriate noises of an army settling in for the night, Washington and some 5,500 men, horses and cannon, had stolen away in the dark. But instead of heading south to Bordentown, as would be expected, he struck off on a wide, daring sweep on little-known back roads to attack Cornwallis's rear guard at Princeton. They marched east to Sandtown, then north-northeast to Quaker Bridge by mud roads frozen as hard as rock. Fields along the way were covered with hoarfrost, and with a few dim stars overhead the night was not as dark as it might have been. But for men with scant clothing and broken shoes or no shoes, it was again an extreme ordeal. Washington's plan, as at Trenton, was again to divide his force, with Greene's column going off to the left, Sullivan's column to the right. The battle broke out at sunrise, Friday, January 3rd, when Greene's vanguard and British forces ran into each other by chance 2 miles out from Princeton. General Hugh Mercer, with several hundred men, went off to the left to destroy a bridge on the King's Highway, to stop any enemy retreat from the town in that direction. Mercer and his men arrived just as the British commander at Princeton, Colonel Charles Mahood, and two regiments were setting off from Princeton to join Cornwallis at Trenton. For the British, the appearance of the Americans at that hour and in such numbers was totally unexpected. They could not possibly suppose it was our army, for that, they took for granted, was cooped up near Trenton, Knox would write. I believe they were as much astonished as if an army had dropped perpendicularly upon them. However, they had not much time for consideration. Both sides opened fire, and in a battle that quickly escalated on the sweeping open fields and orchard of William Clark's farm, the fighting turned as furious as any of the war, the dead and bleeding strewn everywhere. Mercer, who had dismounted when his horse was hit in the midst of a British bayonet attack, fought with his sword until he was clubbed to the ground, then bayoneted repeatedly, bayoneted 7 times, and left for dead. Colonel John Haslett, who tried to rally the brigade, was killed instantly by a bullet in the head. More Americans rushed forward, many of them Pennsylvania militia, with little or no training, who refused to yield as Washington, Greene, and Cadwallader rode among them to lead the way. The sight of Washington set an example of courage such as he had never seen, wrote one young officer afterward. I shall never forget what I felt when I saw him brave all the dangers of the field, and his important life hanging, as it were, by a single hair, with 1,000 deaths flying around him. Believe me, I thought not of myself. Parade with us, my brave fellows, Washington is said to have called out to them. There is but a handful of the enemy, and we will have them directly. More Americans descended on the enemy's flanks, and Mahood and his redcoats were soon in full flight toward Trenton. A resolution was taken to retreat, remembered one of Mahood's junior officers, i.e. run away as fast as we could. Washington, unable to resist, spurred his horse and took after them, shouting, "It's a fine fox chase, my boys." The ferocious battle on the Clark farm, the deciding action of the day, had lasted all of 15 minutes. By the time Washington had reined in his horse and called off the pursuit, another part of the army had entered town, where some 200 of the British garrison there had barricaded themselves inside the large stone main building of the college, Nassau Hall. When Captain Alexander Hamilton and his artillerymen fired a few rounds into the building, the redcoats gave up. The American dead number 23, including Colonel Haslett and General Mercer, who suffered 9 days before dying of his wounds. Mercer, a doctor and pharmacist in civilian life, who came from Fredericksburg, Virginia, not far from Mount Vernon, had been a favorite of Washington's. But losses were greater in British dead and wounded, and the Americans had taken 300 prisoners. The British, though greatly outnumbered, had put up a fierce fight, but for Washington and the army, it was another stunning, unexpected victory. Washington's impulse was to push on to Brunswick, to destroy enemy supplies there and capture a British pay chest of £70,000, and thereby, he speculated, end the war. But his exhausted army was in no shape for another forced march of 19 miles or another battle, and Greene, Knox, and others talked him out of it, warning of the danger of losing all they had gained by aiming at too much. Thus the army marched north to Somerset Courthouse, and in the days that followed, on to the comparative security of the hilly, wooded country near the village of Morristown for the duration of the winter. The campaign of 1776 had ended with a second astonishing victory. Had Washington been born in the days of idolatry, declared the Pennsylvania Journal, he would be worshipped as a god. If there are spots on his character, they are like the spots on the sun, only discernible by the magnifying powers of a telescope. As Nathaniel Greene wrote to Thomas Paine, the two late actions at Trenton and Princeton have put a very different face upon affairs. But as thrilling as the news of Princeton was for the country, coming so quickly after the triumph at Trenton, it was Trenton that meant the most, Trenton and the night crossing of the Delaware, that were rightly seen as a great turning point. With the victory at Trenton came the realization that Americans have bested the enemy, bested the fearsome Hessians, the king's detested hirelings, outsmarted them and outfought them, and so might well again. Among some of the British command and some skeptical Americans, what happened at Trenton was seen only as a minor defeat, an aggravating affair but of no great consequence when compared to such large-scale British victories of 1776 as the Battle of Brooklyn or the taking of Fort Washington. Trenton was a skirmish, an engagement, not a battle. But some on the British side grudgingly conceded that the rabble must henceforth be regarded with new respect. Colonel William Harcourt, the cavalry officer who had led the capture of Charles Lee, wrote in a letter to his father that though the Americans remained ignorant of military order and large-scale maneuver, they had shown themselves capable of great cunning, great industry, and spirit of enterprise. And while it had been the fashion in this army to treat them in the most contemptible light, they are now become a formidable enemy. Measured by the size of its importance to those fighting for the cause of America, those everywhere in the country who saw Washington and his army as the one means of deliverance of American independence, and all that was promised by the Declaration of Independence, Trenton was the first great cause for hope, a brave and truly brilliant stroke. From the last week of August to the last week of December, the year 1776 had been as dark a time as those devoted to the American cause had ever known, indeed, as dark a time as any in the history of the country. And suddenly, miraculously it seemed, that had changed because of a small band of determined men and their leader. A century later, Sir George Otto Trevelyan would write in a classic study of the American Revolution, "It may be doubted whether so small a number of men ever employed so short a space of time with greater and more lasting effects upon the history of the world." Closer to the moment, Abigail Adams wrote to her friend Mercy Otis Warren, "I am apt to think that our later misfortunes have called out the hidden excellencies of our commander-in-chief. Affliction is the good man's shining time," she wrote, quoting a favorite line from the English poet Edward Young. Mercy Warren, the wife of James Warren and an author, would write in her own History of the American Revolution that there were perhaps no people on earth in whom a spirit of enthusiastic zeal is so readily kindled and burns so remarkably as among Americans. The energetic operation of this sanguine temper was never more remarkably exhibited than in the change instantaneously wrought in the minds of men by the capture of Trenton at so unexpected a moment. From the state of mind bordering on despair, courage was invigorated, every countenance brightened. With the new year, news arrived from England that on October 31st in London, His Majesty King George III had once again ridden in splendor from St. James's Palace to Westminster to address the opening of Parliament on the still distressing war in America. "Nothing could have afforded me so much satisfaction," said the King, "as to have been able to inform you that my unhappy people in America recovered from their delusion, had delivered themselves from the oppression of their leaders, and returned to their duty. But so daring and desperate is the spirit of those leaders, whose object has always been dominion and power, that they have now openly renounced all allegiance to the crown and all political connection with this country, and have presumed to set up their rebellious confederacies for independent states. If their treason be suffered to take root, much mischief must grow from it. Another military campaign would be undertaken in America." The same Whig leaders in Parliament spoke out as they had before, ardently denouncing the wicked war. Lord Germain, in response, said the army in America would be reinforced, and as it had before in what seemed the long-ago October of 1775, the Parliament approved the King's policy by an overwhelming margin. When, in March 1777, the news of Trenton reached England, it was said in the London General Evening Post and elsewhere that the defeat of the Hessians, while disagreeable, was more than counterbalanced by the capture of General Lee. Lord Germain saw at once that the importance of the news was the effect it would have on American opinion. Still, he had no doubt that the rebel army was all but finished. In New Jersey, the fighting would continue sporadically as winter wore on. The war itself would continue, endlessly, it seemed to many. In all, it would be another 6.5 years before the Treaty of Paris, ending the war, was signed in 1783. Some who had been with the army in Washington at the beginning, like Joseph Hodgkins, would serve several more years before deciding they had done their duty. Some, like Private Joseph Martin, would serve to the end. In the campaign in the South that set the stage for the last major battle at Yorktown, Virginia, Nathanael Greene would prove the most brilliant American field commander of the war. Washington felt that if anything were to happen to him, were Washington to be captured or killed, Greene should become the commander-in-chief. Of all the general officers who had taken part in the siege of Boston, only two were still serving at the time of the British surrender at Yorktown, Washington and Greene. Henry Knox, who had become a brigadier general after the Battle of Trenton, and who fought in every battle in which Washington took part, was also present at Yorktown. Greene and Knox, the two young, untried New Englanders Washington had singled out at the beginning as the best of the raw material he had to work with, had both shown true greatness and stayed in the fight to the finish. Financial support from France and the Netherlands and military support from the French Army and Navy would play a large part in the outcome. But in the last analysis, it was Washington and the Army that won the war for American independence. The fate of the war and the Revolution rested on the Army. The Continental Army, not the Hudson River, or the possession of New York or Philadelphia, was the key to victory. And it was Washington who held the Army together and gave it spirit through the most desperate of times. He was not a brilliant strategist or tactician, not a gifted orator, not an intellectual. At several crucial moments, he had shown marked indecisiveness. He had made serious mistakes in judgment. But experience had been his great teacher from boyhood, and in this, his greatest test, he learned steadily from experience. Above all, Washington never forgot what was at stake, and he never gave up. Again and again in letters to Congress and to his officers and in his general orders, he had called for perseverance and spirit, for patience and perseverance, for unremitting courage and perseverance. Soon after the victories of Trenton and Princeton, he had written, "A people unused to restraint must be led. They will not be drove." Without Washington's leadership and unrelenting perseverance, the Revolution almost certainly would have failed. As Nathaniel Greene foresaw as the war went on, he will be the deliverer of his own country. The war was a longer, far more arduous, and more painful struggle than later generations would understand or sufficiently appreciate. By the time it ended, it had taken the lives of an estimated 25,000 Americans, or roughly 1% of the population. In percentage of lives lost, it was the most costly war in American history except for the Civil War. The year 1776, celebrated as the birth year of the nation and for the signing of the Declaration of Independence, was for those who carried the fight for independence forward a year of all too few victories, of sustained suffering, disease, hunger, desertion, cowardice, disillusionment, defeat, terrible discouragement, and fear, as they would never forget, but also of phenomenal courage and bedrock devotion to country, and that, too, they would never forget. Especially for those who had been with Washington and who knew what a close call it was at the beginning, how often circumstance, storms, contrary winds, the oddities or strengths of individual character had made the difference. The outcome seemed little short of a miracle.
"1776" was written and read by David McCullough. The recording engineer was Paul Fowley, with editing and post-production by Frog Pond Productions. The mix engineer was Terry Hogan. The associate producer was Suzanne Wetzel. "1776" was produced and directed by Elisa Shokoff. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. "1776" is available in hardcover from Simon & Schuster.
Also from Simon & Schuster Audio, "The Course of Human Events," written and read by David McCullough.